From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg returned to the Supreme Court for the last time 27 years after she arrived as a justice and 49 years after she argued her first case here, beginning the push for women's equality under the law. Inside, the court's eight remaining members and retired Justice Anthony Kennedy gathered with members of her family and friends to hear prayers from Rabbi Lauren Holzblatt, whose husband was a Ginsburg clerk.
From generation to generation, we promise to carry forward your legacy. May you rest under the wings of the Shekhinah, knowing that you have tirelessly served us and this great country.
A lot has been said and written already in tribute to the late giant of the Supreme Court bench, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who passed away just over a week ago at the age of 87. On this week's show, we'll focus on three key aspects of her career and legacy from three distinct angles. The hypocrisy of the mad dash to fill Justice Ginsburg's seat is breathtaking in light of what this same Senate and this same Senate majority leader did to Judge Merrick Garland a mere few years ago. With a history as a clerk for Judge Garland and a seat on the Supreme Court bench, Dr. Jay Michelson will be with us to discuss the process and the players in this high-stakes drama. Even worse is the identity of the likeliest nominee for this traditionally progressive seat on the bench. While any nomination right now is inherently problematic, the identity of the expected individual is rife with problems as well. I spoke Thursday with Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline about Amy Coney Barrett. But first, the titanic impact of Justice Ginsburg's tenure on women's rights in particular and minority rights more broadly can barely be measured. But we'll try to do that to start this week's program with Jody Rabhan, Chief Policy Officer of the National Council of Jewish Women. Jody, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It is terrific to be with you today.
Well, first and foremost, the council has a concrete call to action that I'd like to amplify. Please talk about the hashtag Ruth's Revolution petition that you are asking people to sign.
Sure, and thank you so much for mentioning that. National Council of Jewish Women has long worked on the federal courts, recognizing the importance of the federal courts and the judges who sit on them, and certainly are well aware of all that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg contributed to the rights that we have today. And with that in mind, as the first Jewish woman on the bench, the second woman to serve on the Supreme Court, we want to honor her dying wish and are really working to let senators know that we want to honor her dying wish, which is to ensure her seat is filled by the next president after every vote is counted. In fact, we launched a whole website devoted to the federal courts with a special section. We're calling Ruth's Revolution, with all kinds of ways to get involved and take action. No matter what issue you care about, we believe you have to care about the federal courts. They are often the last arbiter of our rights, and certainly the Supreme Court. This seat could not be more important. It is not inaccurate to say that we have fair pay, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, laws in place against gender discrimination, reproductive rights, all because of Justice Ginsburg. Everything we care about is on the line. Over the years, we have watched and worked as the court has really tilted toward the right. And we know all the cases are winding their way through lower federal courts in hopes of getting to the Supreme Court with a conservative majority. And this is the chance. It will be President Trump's third appointment while he has been president. And already the court has shifted toward the right. This seat is everything. And everything that Justice Ginsburg worked for in her entire career is on the line. So we are hard at work, really trying to do everything we can to highlight the issues at play. Also, we are in the middle of an election. So in many places, early voting and mail-in ballots are happening. We are in the middle of a pandemic, and the Senate has not passed any meaningful COVID legislation, and instead they're prioritizing filling this seat, when in reality, we need time to vet candidates. We need time to learn more about their backgrounds, how they have ruled on issues like voting rights, on health care, abortion rights. The country needs time to get to know them. This is an incredibly important seat, and Ruth Justice Ginsburg really deserves to have her dying wishes heard.
There is a profound commitment deeply embedded in Jewish culture to defend and raise up the marginalized and the forgotten. This is central to the work of the NCJW, and it was central to the tenure of the late Justice Ginsburg. Jody, just talk about that for a minute, if you would.
Indeed. In fact, you know, underline, exclamation point, I think her Jewish values really did determine and inform her worldview. Many people, I'm sure, have heard her story she told during her confirmation hearing about her father, a Jewish immigrant, and her mother, who was barely a second-generation American, and what it meant. And, you know, she remembered when country clubs would bar admission to Jews. And she said one couldn't help but be sensitive to discrimination being a Jew in America during World War II. In her chamber, she had a poster, Tzedek, Tzedek Tirdof, which means justice, justice shall you pursue. And she even wore that line woven into one of her many famous collars that she wore in her Supreme Court robe. She has just talked about the ethics that undergird Jewish religion, and that we're taught to do right, to love mercy, to do justice, not because there's going to be any reward in heaven or punishment in the hell. We live righteously because that's how people should live. So it very much informed her based on how she grew up, her parents, what she saw, the time that she lived through. She said it made her more empathetic to people who are not insiders, but who are outsiders. And it really informed her vision of how she used the law before she was on the Supreme Court, incrementally, to make really important changes. And then once on the bench, as she ruled and issued opinions, I think it was certainly just a tremendous part of who she was and played out in her daily life.
When you look at Justice Ginsburg's long career, what are one or two of the moments that stand out for you in terms of social justice?
Well, I think about all that she did for equality, and certainly the United States versus Virginia case, the VMI case, stands out as probably the most important of her tenure, and is probably the most well-known. She said any differential treatment must not create or perpetuate the legal, social, and economic inferiority of women. It was a resounding case. But there are so many ways in which her voice in cases sort of, you know, bigger and more blockbuster, and then also smaller and lesser known, really changed the face of this country and the way in which our laws work. When you look at abortion, when she was in her addressing the Senate Judiciary Committee, she talked about it being central to a woman's life and to her dignity. And throughout her work while on the Supreme Court, you know, that through line continued. She had a really incredible opinion in a case called Gonzalez versus Carhartt, which was in the 2006-2007 term. And she just talked about the way in which the majority thought about women just reflects ancient notions about a woman's place in the family and under the Constitution. And she, you know, again, that through line, I think, played out from before she was on the court, and it continued while she was on the court. Another one I want to lift up is the Ledbetter v. Goodyear case, in which the court voted to reject basically a woman's pay discrimination claim on the grounds that she didn't meet the deadline. And in her dissent from the bench, Justice Ginsburg said, "The ball's in Congress's court," which, you know, really felt like a thunderous cry that Congress then heeded. And one last case I want to mention was the Shelby County versus Holder case. This is in 2013, an incredibly devastating case for voting rights. And Justice Ginsburg was unusually vocal and really issued a scathing opinion and talked about, you know, throwing out these really key provisions of the Voting Rights Act was like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not going to get wet. I could go on and on, but those are some of the biggies, certainly, for me.
Well, they're wonderful. I see the rejection and even ridicule of norms and traditions that this administration seems to revel in perpetuating as more than just a pendulum swing away from liberalism. In fact, there seems to be a concerted effort to undo and erase the gains made in recent decades, which is pretty much a direct assault on Justice Ginsburg's own legacy. With the stakes as high as they are, Jody, what would the Council of Jewish Women urge everybody to do in such a situation?
I think there's a lot that people can do. We believe in a federal judiciary that is of and for the people, and that judges who serve in lifetime appointments must be fair, independent, and qualified. Reaching out to senators is a key way in which people can make their voices heard. I agree with you that the stakes couldn't be higher, and that the rollbacks that we have seen during this administration, mostly through executive order, executive action, and the regulatory process, is beyond concerning. And the takeover of our federal courts by people who are mostly young, incredibly conservative, and often unqualified, will continue to impact our rights or lack thereof for generations. So reaching out to senators couldn't be more important. For folks listening, it is the Senate that advises and consents on judicial nominations. I think also op-eds, letters to the editors, radio shows, the more vocal people can be about the federal courts and the judges who sit on them, I think the more people will understand the role of the courts in our country. Judges who sit on these courts serve for a lifetime. So while legislation can come and go, it can be repealed, funding doesn't have to be authorized for it. These decisions issued by judges who are on the courts for 30, 40 years, last generation. So cases coming down today will impact my children and their children's children. So we can't sit this one out, and it is not a drill. Socially distanced rallies, getting on Twitter and social media, tweeting at senators, even reaching out to your representative to see what they can do, what relationships they have with senators, and what they're willing to do in terms of speaking out on the floor in Congress in Washington and on their social media and in newspapers, writing their own op-eds and letters to the editor. And of course, you know, getting people who do this work in a material way, particularly in the faith community. You know, as people of faith, we have a huge role to play and a bully pulpit, if you will. And I think there are just no shortages of ways for people of faith to plug in. And I would use all of the ways in which I mentioned in which to do so.
NCJW has been active for 125 years. It is a great organization. And Jody, would you please tell people how they can be in touch with you so they can learn, if they don't already know, your history and some of the things that you're doing now? Please let them know how to get in touch.
Absolutely. Actually, we're into our 127th year.
Oh, my goodness.
What is amazing to see is that so much of the work that we did in our inception is work that we continue to do to this day. And it's really easy to get involved. You can go to our website, mcjw.org, sign up, become an advocate. You can work with us on the national level, join a section. We've got about 60 around the country. And to reach me personally, send me an email. It's J-R-A-B as in boy, H-A-N as in Nancy at ncjw.org. We've got lots of ways to engage on our website and through the courts in particular, through our new website, courtsmatter.org. Join Ruth's Revolution. You can get involved individually. You can join and bring your community along. We've actually got on October 2nd a symbolic walk around the courthouse. We'll be doing it in Washington, D.C., around the Supreme Court, October 2nd at noon, and then around the country at noon local time. We'd love folks to join us.
Jody Rabhan is Chief Policy Officer at the National Council of Jewish Women. Jody, thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Terrific to be with you, and thank you for all that you're doing.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Dr. Jay Michelson is next with an attorney's view on all of this. And later, Rabbi Jack Moline will brief us on how Interfaith Alliance and its partners are working to address this unprecedented situation. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Dr. Jay Michelson is a rabbi, an activist, an author, an attorney, a friend. Admitted to the Supreme Court bar, Jay is a former clerk for Judge Merrick Garland and has unique insights into the breathtaking Republican flip-flop on late-term judicial appointments. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure.
Wow, this is a new low, even for this crowd. When you see the clips of Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and the rest from 2016. What goes through your mind?
Well, that hypocrisy doesn't really matter anymore. It is remarkable that a party that ostensibly is devoted to certain kinds of virtues and moral values throws all of those to the wind when they want to get something. And in this case, that something is a conservative supermajority in the Supreme Court. And they're willing to sacrifice any hint of moral scruples to do that.
I wish you would just remind our listeners about what happened to Judge Merrick Garland, because I also think that shocking behavior should have been a warning on what was to come.
Yeah, I think in retrospect, that seems right. I mean, that was about 280 days before the 2016 election. All of the leading characters who are now in play, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, down the line, said that there's no way that we could consider a nominee to a Supreme Court, to the Supreme Court in an election year. They made that rule up. They claimed that it had existed before, but they really made it up out of whole cloth simply because they wanted to stonewall President Obama's nominee. That worked. Ultimately, they had the power. Mitch McConnell has permanently damaged the Senate by eliminating the filibuster in a lot of these cases, especially around the Supreme Court. That was called the nuclear option. So we're already living in the nuclear winter. You know, it's now, unfortunately, it's now going to be up to the Democrats to radically shift institutions. The only recourse they really have is to increase the size of the court. We probably should get away from this term court packing, which is a negative term, and just accept the fact that while all of us alive have only known 9 justices in the Supreme Court, that is an arbitrary number, and 11 or 13 or even 15 makes just as much sense. So it'll be up to the Democrats, if they win this election in the Senate as well as the the presidency, to fix what the Republicans have broken.
Jay, I just have to ask you, have you had any contact with Judge Garland since that debacle, and do you know how he's been?
I have had a fair amount of contact with him. I'm a former clerk to Judge Garland, and there's an annual clerk get-together. This year it was virtual, of course, but, you know, he's a very steady guy. And as I said, when he was being somewhat semi-considered as a nominee, you know, that was a virtue that he really brought to the bench. He just was a very careful, deliberative thinker. And that's true now, or at least, you know, I haven't spoken to him since Justice Ginsburg passed, but I've been in touch with him earlier this year as well as over the last few years. And I think he is very aware of the fact that, you know, what happened in 2016 had nothing to do with him, that this was a political firestorm that he was caught in the middle of. And, you know, back at that time, when I was in touch with him, he was still preparing for a full nomination vetting process, as if that was going to happen. He was getting ready for hearings, and kind of his attitude was, I'm going to do what my job is, and my job is to be ready and if called. And that's been true over the intervening few years. He's now the chief judge at the D.C. Circuit. That is itself a very important role. And he's been filling it to the, you know, admiration of folks on both sides of the aisle.
You've written articulately on the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg for the Daily Beast, the hypocrisy of trying to ram through a nominee in the last few days of this administration. You call it a power grab by a minority party whose grip on power is slackening. I wish you would talk about that.
On the show, you've had conversations, about the sort of the end of white Christian America, meaning the end of a certain kind of hegemony, of a certain kind of conservative white Christian dominated society. And that's certainly true. Demographically, those numbers are what they are. That's not going to change. Will that tide turn this year, or will it take another couple of election cycles? That I don't know. That's kind of above my pay grade. But it is going to turn. No amount of voter suppression can hold back that change long enough. Of course, now, you know, with each passing day, the stakes get higher. Now the president says he might not respect the orderly transfer of power, which is like a cornerstone of our democracy. But failing something like that, this is a minority party. The Senate, which was conceived, you know, it's kind of too long to go into now, but was conceived as an instrument of maintaining a kind of white supremacy, is functioning that way. It represents, you know, it disproportionately represents a small portion of the country. Senate Republicans won fewer votes than Senate Democrats in the last Senate election, even though they have more seats, right, just because of the nature of small states tending to vote Republican. So it's already an anti-democratic institution that's ruled by a minority party, but they're potentially in line to lose even that. That is inevitable, whether it happens in 2020 or 2024 or some other time, that is going to happen. And so these should be understood as rear guard action, as desperately trying to maintain power as long as possible. But ironically, maybe it's not ironic, maybe it's just deservedly, the harder they try to do that, the quicker that power will disappear, because this is something, this is not, many times you and I have spoken about how liberals don't care about the courts as much as conservatives do. Mm-hmm. That's not true now, right? Now we have a Supreme Court battle looming right in the center of this contentious election, right in the center of racial justice protests, and right in the center of the pandemic. So it's right up there. And it's right in front of folks. And this may well animate Donald Trump's hard right base as well, but it certainly puts the court front and center. And that hopefully will be true in Senate elections, too. Mitch McConnell is in a tight race for his own Senate seat. There's certainly plenty of outside money supporting his opponent, Amy McGrath, and hopefully that will increase because this is one man who has really misshapen the entire federal court system for the last 4 years and has junked every standard of Senate procedure that stood in his way. So whether it's the approval of home state senators for judicial nominees, whether it's the process, the confirmation process, which he expedited, I've described it as turning it into a Las Vegas wedding in one of my Daily Beast pieces. And, you know, simply how, whether it's requiring ABA certifications, the Republicans have rubber stamped a number of unqualified judges who are now there with life tenure. And all of that's happened kind of maybe a little bit behind the scenes, but it's not behind the scenes now. And so I do have a little bit of optimism that this power grab will have consequences.
So, Jay, when you write there will be hell to pay, what do you mean?
I mean that two things in particular. First, what we just talked about, that this is now a very high profile issue for the left as well as the right. And second, the Democrats themselves. I mean, if they do retake power of all three, you know, the Senate, the House and the presidency, any pretense that they need to play nice, you know, when they go low, we go high, is gone. I mean, this is what's happening now with this judicial confirmation process is a complete travesty. It is an outrageous manipulation and display of hypocrisy such that we have not seen even from this Senate. And anyone with a conscience can see that. One may think that hypocrisy is justified in order to save unborn life or something like that, but you have to admit that it's there. So the gloves will be off. And the hell to pay, if the voters show up at the polls in November, the hell to pay will be ramming a lot of things through over minority objections. It'll mean, you know, filling judicial seats with no regard for anything like the filibuster or the shoe will be on the other foot. Mm-hmm. Justice Ginsburg cited that old cliche in an oral argument just last year. What's good for the sauce that's good for the goose is good for the gander. And this is the new normal. And there can be no conversation that, oh, well, Democrats shouldn't disturb the integrity of their court or the system or anything like that. That's already gone out the window. So I was never one to publicly support changing the size of the Supreme Court or taking drastic measures like that, but I am now. And that's the hell to pay. This you can't do what they're doing now and not expect there to be payback.
I've got two questions for you, and I want to get both of them in if I can. Ultimately, is the Amy Coney Barrett thing a done deal, do you think?
No, I don't think. One thing that Donald Trump has done with his two Supreme Court picks is defy conventional wisdom. I just finished, I think the piece will be launching by the time this airs, a long profile of Judge Barrett and her positions on key issues. She is the odds-on favorite. She's an extremely qualified candidate. Qualified doesn't mean someone I would personally want to see on the bench, but you know, she's exceptionally intelligent, capable, and with no ethical blemishes on her record. So she is sort of the perfect candidate, but it could be anything. It seems, you know, it seems that Trump may well make politics the deciding factor in who he picks. And so I wouldn't say it's a done deal, no. I would say that whoever he picks is going to be put on the court. That is a done deal.
Yeah. So this week, the president cast doubt on the peaceful transfer of power itself, a core value this nation has prided itself on for centuries. How does that tie in with who's on the high court? And this is really important, what should all of us be doing right now?
All of us progressives should be phone banking and clearing our schedules for the first week of November to help people vote and do get out the vote. This is a base election. It's the middle is barely exists. Very few people are undecided. The polls are still pretty good for Joe Biden, but it's a matter of who shows up at the polls and who's able to show up at the polls. You know, there is violence on the streets right now in Louisville. Louisville is in Kentucky, right? Mitch McConnell's home state. Kentucky is a state that has gerrymandered the hell out of its congressional districts and has closed all but one polling place in its largest community, its largest black community. So this is the new Jim Crow writ large. And so this is a good example, right? I mean, if people of color are able to show up to the polls, and if they're able to wait 4 hours in the middle of a pandemic because they can't vote by mail because Kentucky doesn't want them to vote, if they're able to actually triumph over all of the obstacles that Mitch McConnell and his party are putting in their ways, well, there could be real change, right? But it's going to take a lot of support. It's not just to tell someone, an individual, that you have to individually jump through all these hurdles and jump over all these obstacles that a gigantic machine is putting in your place. That person needs support, and that support is us. And so whether that means showing up physically, personally, and helping folks vote, or whether it means getting on the phone, or whether it means having, you know, conversations, individual conversations, one voter at a time, that's what we need to be doing. I may regret these words, but I think a lot of what Donald Trump says right now is just to get headlines, distract, and feed his base, right? And anytime liberals get outraged, his base gets very happy, right? They get to own the libs. So I refuse to give them that happiness and that satisfaction. He can say what he wants. What I'd like to see is a world in which this is not a close election, in which the Electoral College margin, you know, is quite significant, and that everybody sees exactly what's happened. That makes his threats even more empty than I think they already are.
Dr. J. Michelson is a rabbi, attorney, an author, and an activist who is also a meditation teacher and a frequent contributor to the Daily Beast and other publications. His books include Enlightenment by Trial and Error, 10 Years on the Slippery Slopes of Jewish Spirituality, Postmodern Buddhism, and Other Mystical Heresies. Thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure. Let's get out there and work, folks.
Interfaith Alliance and its partner organizations are accustomed to juggling many priorities at once, particularly in recent years. But this week might be a record breaker, nonetheless. For a look at what I mean, I'm happy to welcome Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline back to State of Belief Radio. Jack, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to be with us today.
Welton, it's a relief to be able to talk with somebody who has already responded, as I have, to the news this week.
Oh, my goodness. Interfaith Alliance has been communicating two distinct messages in the days since the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What are the two, and why are they important?
Well, the first message, Welton, is of course the sadness that we have over the loss of the justice. Whether or not you agreed with her judicial philosophy, and whether or not you subscribed to her opinions in the cases that were decided by the Supreme Court, she was unquestionably a towering figure in American jurisprudence. Sort of an ironic position for her to be in, since she was physically so diminutive and joked about it herself. So the first message that we wanted to put out was America needs to take the time to grieve for this remarkable, remarkable American, and to do so without exploiting the questions that are raised by her untimely passing. I hope that that people took the time that I was able to take this weekend because of the occurrence of the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, of the Jewish New Year, that sort of took me away from all of the barrage of news media and the like, to be able to reflect on the contribution that she made in the context of the values that, as an observant Jew, I am connected to. But the second message that we put out there, Welton, is that this is sort of a critical decision-making time for the United States. Following the precedent of what happened just before the 2016 election, we believe that the decision as to who should take the place of Justice Ginsburg should be left to the person who is elected in this year's federal elections. That is, whoever the President of the United States will be on January 20th of next year. If that is President Trump, then his choice is clearly his choice. If it is former Vice President Biden, then by the standards set by the Republicans themselves, it ought to be his choice. But if that decision is not going to be made by the president elected on November 3rd, then there are significant questions that need to be asked of any nominee. In fact, even if that decision is made by the president elected on November 3rd, there are significant questions that need to be asked, and we have published them. Would you like to hear them?
Yes, it'd be fine.
Great. First of all, we think that any justice ought to be asked what role, if any, their personal faith or philosophy plays in their judicial philosophy. That's a critical question when we're thinking about whether decisions will be made strictly in line with a constitutional perspective, or whether there are other values that will come into play. Interfaith Alliance clearly believes that it is the Constitution which should be the sole determinant of judicial decisions. And we need to know if that is not what a nominee to the court believes. The second question is, if a conflict arose between their faith and their obligations to the Constitution, how it would be resolved. I would like to tell you that that question is not a question at all. I'd like to tell you that President Kennedy resolved that when he was a candidate, and he said, I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. And he prefaced it by saying, it isn't which church he believes in, it's which America he believes in. But we have lots of people in this country right now who are claiming that their understanding of God's law supersedes the Constitution. And such a person, in my opinion, is not qualified to be in charge of interpreting the Constitution. The third question we ask is how they understand the Establishment Clause. And as you know, as our listeners know, the Establishment Clause prevents the government from favoring any religion or even religion in general over anybody else's belief system. If a candidate is a believer in any kind of religious supremacy, then that's violation of the Establishment Clause. The fourth question we would ask is whether the free exercise clause supersedes the rights of others. This is the test of I can swing my arms freely until I reach the edge of your nose. And obviously our belief is that the personal beliefs of any individual citizen or any group of citizens do not truncate the rights and privileges of any other citizen in the United States if what they're seeking to do is both permitted by the law and in some cases even recommended by the law. And lastly, the question that we want to ask any nominee is, should taxpayer dollars be permitted to fund the mission of religious institutions? And if so, should the government be allowed to regulate the use of those dollars? We have lots of examples in which faith-based institutions have sought government contracts and funding, but have done so with the understanding that they have to meet the stringent nonpartisan and secular values that are presented by the government in mandating that contract. There are those who believe, especially in the wake of funding that's come for COVID relief, that the government can fund partisan and parochial activities in religious institutions. And with tax dollars comes the demand of oversight. It's part of the public trust. Do we have a justice who believes that the government can interfere in the workings of your local church or your denomination? So those are the questions we want to ask.
Jack, when I was sitting where you're sitting, we had a time or two when we were dealing with what's going to happen at the Supreme Court. I want our listeners to know, hear what you've just heard from Jack Moline is a tremendous difference between what our approach to our work does and what the religious right does. The religious right says God's talked to us and we know who needs to be there. We say it is important that we quiz people so that we know whether or not our Constitution is going to stay intact by the person who is in that seat. That is a crucial, crucial difference between the way the religious right works and the way Interfaith Alliance works. We ask questions, not make demands that God has told us we can use God's name to do that with. It is important, people. It is important.
So, well, I only want to amplify what you just said. When you and I are having this conversation, we do not yet know who or even if the president is going to nominate sometime this weekend or afterwards. All right. Who he nominates is likely endorsed by people on the religious right for exactly the reasons that you outlined that they make their decisions. We at Interfaith Alliance have a terrible dilemma if that happens, because following your precedent, we've been very reluctant to endorse or oppose any nominee, and certainly we are constrained from endorsing or opposing any candidate for elected office by our 501c3 status. But if we wind up raising objection to one nominee or another, it will not be because we have a different faith perspective on who that person is. In fact, we will defend to the death the prohibition of a religious test for office, no matter what that office is. It would be on the constitutional grounds that form the basis of our collaboration as an American citizenry.
Absolutely. And that's what makes me so proud of our organization. With everything that's going on right now, it was heartening to see so many people gather for candlelight vigils to pay tribute to Justice Ginsburg. Do you see a similar focus on what's happening to her seat on the High Court?
I think that people drawn together to pay tribute to the late justice are doing so out of a sense of loss. As I said earlier, even if they didn't agree with her perspective or some of her opinions, I see people lining up on opposite sides of an imaginary divide about how that seat should be filled and with whom it should be filled. And frankly, it's distressing because the conversations are not about who will bring the proper judicial temperament and the proper constitutional perspective to that seat. It's being framed by both sides, although primarily by the religious right, as to who will do our bidding, who will undo decisions about reproductive health care for women, who will allow for a greater preference for a certain kind of Christianity in this country, who will allow greater power in the hands of wealthy private citizens than the American public. That's the wrong conversation to be having here. The right conversation to be having is who is best qualified to apply the Constitution as it is meant to be applied for the betterment of all Americans.
Jack, what sets Amy Coney Barrett apart from the other Heritage Foundation-approved judges on the list this administration has frequently touted?
So herein lies a dilemma in terms of questioning, and I want to emphasize again that Article 6 of the Constitution does not allow for a religious test for office. I am delighted that that she has an active and meaningful spiritual life in her private life. But there is an indication that she is a member of a right-wing religious group that asked her as part of her membership to sign a covenant that describes a particular way of looking at the relationships between men and women that commits her to doing God's will above all other as it is understood by this particular group, and that may presuppose her willingness to decide matters of sexual orientation, of reproductive health, of federal policy on the basis of commitments that have nothing to do with the Constitution, have everything to do with the particular religious perspective that she seems to have committed to. Now, there are lots of people who may hold those commitments privately, but to the best of my knowledge, she's the only person being mentioned as a nominee who has a piece of paper that she apparently, and I haven't seen it, so I can't say for sure, she apparently signed that commits her to those things that are unquestionably, in my mind, unconstitutional.
The political religious right is predictably oversimplifying the debate to claim that simply being a Christian is what makes Barrett unacceptable to the so-called radical left. In the face of that kind of dishonesty, Jack, where do we even begin trying to set the record straight?
You know, the only thing we can do is rely on precedent, not only precedent of who served on the court, but precedent in whom we as dissenters from that particular perspective have shown respect and appreciation for in their service on the court. I point, for example, to Justice Kennedy, who is himself devout and deeply engaged in his faith community. I had the opportunity to speak with him about that and about his respect for the First Amendment and the religious freedom clauses of the First Amendment, both philosophically and in terms of his personal commitment. He was very proud of the fact that his children went to a Jewish preschool when they were young and that it gave them the opportunity as a family to discuss the distinction between what they practiced at home, what their personal commitments are, and what the Constitution guaranteed for all people. Even with children at a young age, and he brought that with him to the court. he was certainly someone who decided frequently in the opposite direction that we might have preferred as Interfaith Alliance. But there was no question that he was doing so on the grounds he understood to be constitutional and not on the basis of a particular religious faith. Likewise, I will tell you that, though I'd be hard-pressed to start naming the cases, Justice Kagan, Justice Breyer, Justice Ginsburg have all either written opinions or been in a cohort of people who have decided differently than we would have hoped. All of them Jewish, all of them share that with me. I had no hesitation to criticize some of the things that they have done on the court and before they came to sit on the court that I considered to be unconstitutional, even if they were able to justify them in terms of values I might share as a Jew.
Jack, one last question I simply have to ask before we get off. It was alarming to hear the president prove the cynics right and open the door to refusing a peaceful transfer of power. We heard what would be a violation of any pledge that he made at the oath of office. This is not a bridge that we can wait to cross if we get to it. Is there guidance from Interfaith Alliance on responding to this anti-constitutional outrage?
So we don't have a formal statement yet, Weldon, because this is something that, though the president has sort of danced around it a little bit, this is the first time he's been quite so explicit. And I think some of our readers may have seen some of the recent writing that's been done in the media about how he might go about frustrating the will of the people and the constitutional practices of our elections. I will say that we at Interfaith Alliance will not stand for anything that compromises the democracy we're trying to preserve. How we'll do that, what we'll say about it, and what the basis of it will be is subject to conversations that I will have with our leadership, both our board leadership and our staff leadership. But you can expect that even if we can't come up with something that makes it sound like it's the mission of Interfaith Alliance, the president of Interfaith Alliance will be out in the streets making sure that this doesn't happen.
Jack, I'm really glad you're there, and I'm glad that you have that in you ready to go. Know that we are behind you. Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. Jack, as always, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton, and go Cubs.
Before we go, I don't want this week's show to go by without marking my 10th anniversary of working with producer Ray Kirstein. We first met in 2006 when State of Belief was being launched at Air America Radio in New York City, where Ray was director of creative services and working with various new weekend programs. Prior to Air America, Ray had been a producer at Sirius Satellite Radio for 4 years, but he had a passion for what we were trying to do at the intersection of religion, government, and politics, and he eventually stepped in as producer of this program in late September of 2010. A great day for State of Belief and for me. There have been any number of obstacles that came close to derailing this project over the years, and it's rather remarkable to consider that we are still here, working together after a full decade. Relocated to Germany in 2012, I retired from leading Interfaith Alliance in Washington, D.C. in 2015. The show has gone from being physically based in New York and Washington to Leipzig, Germany, and Monroe, Louisiana. But with the commitment and support of many of our listeners and of Interfaith Alliance, we've been able to continue bringing you stories of leaders and activists, organizers and trailblazers who find different ways for religion to be a force for good in our nation, upholding the crucial constitutional principle that ours is a nation of rights and opportunities for people of faith and of no faith, and resist the temptation of majoritarian dominance and denominational divisiveness that has so painfully pervaded our country. There are times we ask ourselves, how will this make a difference? And often we don't have an answer to that question. But with confidence, I can say this. It's better that these conversations happen. It's better that even a few of us pause and consider the consequences of doing nothing and the potential of doing something in the service of the nation we love and the values we espouse. And it's better that we can spend this time together, even if apart, remembering that none of us is alone in what we mourn, what we celebrate, and what we treasure. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people to conversation and to company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. They probably will thank you for it. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.